Running a business keeps you on your toes. Wouldn't it be great if your internet connection could keep up? Introducing Business Class Fiber from Vox. It's super fast, reliable, and highly cost-effective. You get unlimited calls to all SA destinations, and it's scalable. So no matter the size of your business, you've still got room to grow. Get connected with Business Class Fiber from Vox and see what super fast internet really means. For more information, visit vox.co.za.
Bitco is revolutionizing the way businesses connect. We're taking on your connectivity challenges and shooting our high-speed fiber internet across the country. Not just for some, but for everyone. Fiber is not a luxury, but a necessity. For business, for life, for you. And being connected is everything. So network with a Tier 1 internet provider and take your business to the next level of connectivity. Bitco.co.za. Connectivity is everything.
So I am not a friend of ANC policy. I'm going to make that very clear right up front, because I firmly believe that in spite of the good words that have been used in their policy statements, when it comes to actually turning those policies into legislation, they actually change their direction, and instead of facilitation, they focus on control and limitation. So having given that as my opening statement, I will take you through the comments that the Institute officially made to the department in reaction to the publication of the white paper, of the amendment bill. And I have to agree with Jane's opening remarks that there was a fair amount of consternation around the difference between the sentiments expressed in the Green Paper and what came out in the White Paper. And then having had those industry interactions following the White Paper, we thought that there would be some change in attitude in certain aspects of the amendment bill, and that was not to come. So just briefly on the points that we raised to the department, and this really goes in the sequence in which they appear in the bill, just because that was the easiest way of dealing with them. The first thing that came up was the question of allocation of spectrum and the intention for the responsibility of that to move from the independent regulator to the minister, and I will come back to that. But we made the point that the expertise for allocation of spectrum is very technical, and we do not expect our ministers to be good at that sort of stuff. Ministers are supposed to be looking at the needs of people and directing policy accordingly. Then we talked about the way in which the wireless open access network was defined, because it isn't a wireless open access network, it's a wholesale open access network, simply because the network depends on both cable and wireless to be implemented. And that we felt that if there was to be reference to a WOAN, that it should make it clear that it was talking about a wholesale network. Our next concern was whether or not the ministry, the department, understands the telecommunications market. They put some words into Section 2 of the amendment bill, which we felt were based on a misunderstanding of how the market has evolved, and were intended to create the misconception that market forces are in some way unreasonable. Market forces around something as massive and complex as telecommunications are incredibly difficult to understand. Of course, there is the basic notion of the capital investment and investors needing return on capital and looking for the best returns they can get. And in the environment that was created by legislation for telecommunications in South Africa, it became, hesitant to call it a gravy train, but it became a very lucrative path to be on, to put a mobile network into South Africa in competition with the aged, incompetent fixed line network that Telkom had. But think back, when that all started, the powers that be, including some of the investors, thought the market for mobile telephones in this country would peak at 500,000 phones. 500,000. They never understood that this country, having suffered the inability to communicate with each other and the outside world, depending on a Noma Asip leaf twisted pear, would grasp the opportunity to get a mobile phone the way they did. And it didn't matter that it was expensive. It met a need that was there to be met. And the operators, particularly companies like Vodafone through Vodacom and MTN, saw the opportunity and were prepared to invest to make it happen. They cannot be blamed for the way the market developed. Can't paint them as some sort of evil person because they took advantage. That's what business does. So I wanted to reinforce that this understanding in government of the market doesn't exist. And it's made even more clear because the bill itself contains significant reference to the need for market analysis and reporting. Several times it says we need to analyze the market. Why are you then producing this piece of legislation about a market that you patently don't understand because you don't have enough information? Okay, moving on a bit. The next area that we commented on was the need for rapid deployment. The bill talks about facilitating rapid deployment of infrastructure. Great. But there is a very ambitious plan to collect data and analyze it before deployment can happen. And as I made a point later on, that means it isn't going to be rapid. It's going to be held up because we don't know what we need to know. We looked at the bill's comments on equity ownership and repeated what's been said before, that we're disappointed that government overlooked the opportunity to fully align the transformation obligations of licensees with those of the broader country. We have legislation around broad-based black economic empowerment, including all of the definitions of who the beneficiaries should be. Why is it different in the regulation of licensed operators? Sure, those regulations came in before the BEE Act, but there have been many opportunities to align those definitions. They've missed another opportunity to do so. Then if we talk about the WOAN, if anything turned out to be an unfortunate acronym, that one, it's very closely aligned to MOAN, and we are moaning about the WOAN non-stop. I've already made the point about wholesale instead of wireless, and the opportunity to put some sanity back into that proposal came when the Big Six had their negotiations behind closed doors. How closed are they? We all know what happened. And they thought that they had introduced a flexible approach to it, but that apparently has not happened. And we as an institute firmly believe that the opportunity to share infrastructure on a more equitable basis is there without having to mess with the law. We already have mobile virtual network operators, so they are operating the retail level on top of a wholesale network. And one of the interesting things for me was the support of the internet service providers for the WOAN on the basis that it would enable them to have a fair crack at the playing field. What they didn't say is that there are 400 plus internet service providers already making a fairly reasonable living out of a wholesale arrangement with the existing network. So what were they hoping for by the introduction of a WOAN? Lower input costs, obviously. But there is no proof anywhere that that is what they would get. None. And if they're already 400 successful competitive ISPs, what are they complaining about? The current network serves them pretty well. And of course, the whole issue around whether or not the spectrum that everybody requires would be available once the WOAN was put in place. Yeah, rapid deployment, just to reinforce what I said earlier. It says that the Rapid Deployment National Coordinating Center, there's a wonderful set of letters, would take up to 24 months from its establishment to develop the processes to enable rapid deployment. So 2 years before you even start implementing processes to deploy things. That's not rapid deployment. That's just putting off the evil day for as long as you can. One of the other phrases that comes in is under Section 20M, I think it is, whether that provides a disincentive to invest in infrastructure, because it says all users within a defined property or premises must rely on the facilities of a single access provider. Okay? So your walled housing estate, your office block, this group of offices here, would only be allowed to contract one access provider. And if that access provider goes offline for any reason, you're dead. No communications whatsoever. No alternatives. Who on earth dreams up these things? I'm going to not too worried about some of this stuff. One really interesting point was around license duration. Existing licensees have been given long-term licenses for very good reasons. They had to invest massive amounts of money, and the only way they were going to get a return on investment was to be able to generate income over a long period. That's perfectly acceptable on big infrastructure projects. That's why we enter into long-term rental agreements when we build office blocks or housing estates. Okay? So suddenly it says the no matter what the duration of the license, it will be renewable annually. Excuse me? Does that mean my license comes to an end every year and I have to now negotiate with you to get another year out of it? I know as an independent consultant, I have an annual contract with my client. And at the end of that year, I have to negotiate whether or not I can provide services for another year. That I understand. But if I've signed for a license that expires in 2028, why must I now be subject to an annual renewal process? Doesn't make sense. So not only unconstitutional, it's illegal. I think there was a section where it said the authority, I presume ICASA, must impose universal access and service obligations on existing licensees. Again, I have entered into a license agreement, a contract with government that says they give me this and I give them that. How can we now produce a piece of law in place that says, we're going to give you a whole bunch of new obligations because the ones we thought we had didn't work? On to the matter of what is high demand spectrum. You know, the only reason that we have high demand spectrum is because government messed up the allocation of it in the first place and has spent 10 years not implementing the migration of digital, terrestrial television to digital signals. If we had overcome that, when we should have, then we wouldn't have a fight over spectrum right now. We would have operational trials of 5G. We would have LTE rolled out on a far wider geographical base than it currently is. So I don't buy the argument that somehow government has to interfere in the process of allocating spectrum that is useful for certain types of communication and for reaching certain types of market. I've already said I don't think the minister should be involved in technicalities of radio frequency allocations, and it should stay with the authority. And if the authority lacks whatever expertise it needs, it must be allowed to engage it. To finish on, because I think one should always be amused by something in law, even though it's pretty miserable sort of a subject. In the section on roaming amongst SADC countries, there is a phrase in clause 42A1D that prices should not be too excessive. Now, my understanding of English says that that is okay for prices to be excessive, but they mustn't be too excessive. And who's going to decide that? So with that, I want to thank you for listening. I have opinions that probably the Institute doesn't allow me to express because I'm standing here on their behalf, but they do give me a fair latitude to say things the way that I want to say them. So, yes, we should have telecommunications legislation. It should be entirely focused on facilitation, not control. And it should be in the hands of people who understand the contribution that ICTs should be making to the economic growth of South Africa. And I spend a lot of time trying to assist people to focus on that side of the issue rather than whether or not it's too expensive to make a telephone call to a friend of mine. So with that, thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions that may arise, or you may like to let Leon say his piece and then ask both of us, but that's up to you.
Adrian, you make it somewhat easy for me to proceed with my part, and unashamedly I will not be diplomatic, and if I were, you'd all be disappointed. If you can't handle straight talk, then this is the time to leave. If you can handle robust talk, then stay and let's have it. But I'm going to be very critical of this, more critical and more stridently critical than I would normally be of proposals, because this one has a very dodgy history, apart from dodgy content. It's dodgy twice over, sort of double layers of dodginess. So I'm going to address some of that, and as you can see over here, I'm going to argue, let me just see if I've got the light right, yes, that it's probably void for vagueness. I'm going to give that first, because this is an element that has not yet, as far as I know, been aired in public or properly debated, is whether this is actually legislation which would pass constitutional muster, and if it were challenged in the Constitutional Court, what is the court likely to find? So I'm going to spend a bit of time on that because it's new, let's say, this is the new bit. And the rest is that it's a terrible idea, failed idea, anti-progress idea, and some would argue, I mean, the word, the whispering in the corridors, when you say why, people say, well, it's corrupt. This is just a way of creating business opportunities for Pels, and I don't know much about that, but nonetheless, it is a widely held whispering in the corridors. I'm going to start off with the single word that sums up all of economics, and if you can just remember this word alone, I've arranged with the WITS economics department that you can get a PhD in economics just by going and saying this word. If you say this, you get your degree. And so just remember it. This is it. If you can remember this, you understand essentially everything about economics and law and legislation. And this is the word that is completely ignored in this bill and in the white paper. It's as if this doesn't exist. In other words, as if no economist has had anything to do with it or no lawyer. And this word is simply the acronym for there ain't no such thing as a free lunch. And Tonstafel. Now, this bill presupposes lots of free lunches. It presupposes benefits at zero cost on steroids, on a grand scale, as if you can just wave a magic wand and get incredible benefits, free and cheap access without anyone having to pay. So let me delve into the new bit. This is, if for media people, would be, I suppose, the most newsworthy part, because the rest has been said. And I'm indebted to Martin van Staden, who's with us here, a lawyer who's done some work on this. But I take entire responsibility for what I say. None of this is attributable to him, other than that he helped me clarify my thoughts. And we're only at the early stages of analyzing this. The WAN, the wireless or wholesale, depending on what you mean, open access network, is undefined in any coherent way in the bill or in the white paper. It's more defined in the white paper than the bill, but the bill has plunged it into deeper confusion, and it's plunged into even deeper confusion by comments by the Director General, who at this consultation, when asked what does it mean, he basically said, well, we haven't decided, we must sit down and talk about it, and it's some future decision. So now there's a bill before Parliament that wants to create a wireless open access network without the DG himself knowing what is meant by it, and whether it's going to be private or public and private or only government, whether it's going to be a monopoly, not a monopoly, compete, whether it's going to be run on commercial lines, not commercial lines, who will manage it and own it, will it be a listed company, won't it, will it be some sort of co-op, will it be some kind of new entity created in law? He does not know, and nobody knows. Nobody in this room can know, because this has never been clarified. So we're talking here about creating a giant organization, potentially. It could be very small, it could be massive. It could be as big as all the network providers combined, or it could be some little outfit that operates in a few remote valleys where there isn't yet service provision. And there aren't many of those, because 98% of population already has coverage. So nobody knows, and he does not know, and he said he does not know. I was quite startled that he actually had, if I may say, the temerity to tell the people in the consultation that, well, we don't really know. We haven't decided exactly what we mean by it, but nonetheless, we're going to make a law about it. And so now, can you imagine the Constitutional Court being asked, is this real law? Is this law with any kind of degree of certainty? Does it meet any of the criteria required in the Constitution for something to be a law? I would bet money on it that the Constitutional Court would say, I'm sorry, this can't, in any objective sense of the word, be considered a law.
It goes further. Oh dear, why is it doing that? It's sort of leapt ahead here. I'll get back to what's missing there for some reason. Sometimes PowerPoint does that. I think I have to show what precedes it. Is it going to appear? There we go. It talks about all these terms which Adrian referred to: wireless open access, wholesale open access, general open access. What do they mean? I could go into each, but for example, the word general is meant to mean access to the network that is effective, transparent, and non-discriminatory. So it says there must be general open access, that's obligatory, and that's how it's defined. Now you tell me, what on earth does that mean? And under what conditions do you not provide? Is it, who decides if it's effective, not effective? Who decides if it's true? It doesn't say the minister decides, or the government, or the department. It's just a law that ends there. Now, Hugh Lane is a formidable lawyer sitting in the audience, and you know, I'd like him to tell me whether he thinks this is some kind of justiciable, which is the word you would use in law. In other words, could you bring an action that a court could make a ruling on regarding such vague terms? What does transparent mean? You know, general open access, transparent. Does that mean you have to disclose your secret industrial technology for equipment that you bought abroad that's subject to patent rights, etc., etc.? What does it mean in this context? It's really unknowable. And then it says it has to be cost-based. The DG, when he's asked, does that mean you have to supply it at cost? Or does it mean cost plus a profit? Cost plus a fixed markup? What does it mean? He said, well, we haven't decided that yet. So the word cost-based, which is like critical. I mean, this is so profound and fundamental to the whole nation that these ISPs, independent service providers, are going to get cost-based access to the networks. But the minute the DG himself says, well, we actually don't know what we mean by that. We'll decide that as we go along. And let me make a point that was not being made as far as I can tell. What the cost is actually incalculable. There is no accounting methodology whereby you can say the cost of a particular bit of spectrum in the Tugela Valley is X, because it's part of a whole complex bundle of spectrum allocations and accounting. And if you say to an accountant, what is the cost of a particular bit of spectrum in the Tugela Valley in some village there, it could be the village of Nkandla, for example, there is no accounting way to calculate it. It's not a knowable number. So you can't even, so you have a law here that says you have an unknowable number, and you don't know what you want to do with that number. Do you charge that number, or do you add something to it, or do you make a profit, or whatever? Now, you can imagine cost-based has been assumed, by the way, by most people to mean no markup, no profit. Well, that'll just, of course, be an end to all investment, not just to investment at running a 10 billion rand a year of rollout of new technology and network, but maintenance of that network will stop. If all you can recover from cost is the network itself will sort of break down within, you know, 2 or 3 years or whatever it is. I don't know how long it survives if no one maintains it. But if you have what the industry assumes it means, no markup, but I don't think they're entitled to make that assumption. In fact, the DG said maybe it does mean a markup. We don't know. Then you can expect the networks to slowly just wind down, and we'll go back to using, you know, 10,000 telecom phones or whatever it was in the bad old apartheid days. Then the high demand spectrum, so-called. It's completely incoherently defined. It says high demand spectrum means where demand exceeds supply. What on earth does that mean? You know, does the demand for bananas at Pick n Pay exceed the supply of bananas at Pick n Pay? I don't know. I suppose since there's some on the shelf, it means supply exceeds demand. If there are none on the shelf, it means demand exceeds supply. That's typically how an economist would think about it, but it's a completely incoherent statement. Where demand exceeds supply, that's called high demand spectrum. In economics, just for what it's worth, there is no such thing as a surplus of demand or supply. There's a wrong price. In other words, there's no surplus of Rembrandt paintings or shortage of Rembrandt paintings. The price for them is simply correct. and supply meets demand. So economics knows no such thing as demand exceeding supply, other than if the price is regulated, in which case just don't regulate the price, then supply and demand will never exceed one or the other. And they will always gravitate towards a so-called market clearing price. Then also it says where the spectrum is fully assigned, it's called high demand spectrum. What does that mean? All spectrum that is assigned anywhere is fully assigned. That particular wavelength is assigned. That's it. You don't have it sort of half assigned. You can use every second peak on the wavelength or something. It's just meaningless terminology, gobbledygook, I'm afraid to say, and I would like to know if you, Lane, agrees with me. He probably hasn't looked at the bill itself, but I think these are just very, very elementary entry-level law 101 points. They're not even complicated, not even debatable. Then it talks about virtual entities, and I won't go into them, but what on earth is a virtual entity? It's either virtual or it's an entity. But these virtual entities, whatever they are, these ghost-like things that float around somewhere in the spectrum, have powers and obligations, very considerable powers and obligations. But nowhere does it tell us what is this thing called a virtual entity. And then spectrum itself that will go to this supposed WoWAN, which we don't know what it is, and it will go to cost, we don't know what the cost is, and there'll be virtual entities sort of hovering around, we don't know what they are. But what spectrum will it get? Will it get all the spectrum that was originally presumed to be what the white paper said, or will it get only high demand spectrum, which itself is indefinable or vaguely defined, or not defined in the bill? Let's put it that way. Someone like Adrian could define it, but that's not what's in the bill. Or does it mean the spectrum released by digital migration, or the spectrum that is currently unassigned, or spectrum that's reassigned or reallocated? Well, you know, you just don't know. So this is the degree of vagueness. It's really quite beyond comprehension. So the WoWAN is an entity, and this is how, to the extent it's defined at all, an entity. It doesn't say whether it's a company, a club, a government corporation, a partnership, a PPP, an IPP, whatever it is, nobody knows. It doesn't say, but it's called an entity, whatever that means in law. I don't know if you can tell us if there's a legal coherent meaning of the word entity. Hugh, after all, is an entity. So, I mean, there's an entity right there. And you're an entity. And this is an entity. So we've got lots of entities around, and one of these entities is going to have these awesome powers, which will redress skewed access by a few. Now, what does that mean? 98% coverage. So only a few, you know, that's a hell of a big few, let's put it that way. That's a lot of few, if that means access by a few. This is going to be sort of fixed. We're going to have, you know, 99% instead of only 98, or, you know, maybe if we're very lucky, 100%. That, by the way, is by population, not by area, which is important because I was driving around last week in the northern remote parts of KZN, in the Shishlui, Kuzi, Manzini area, visiting schools and looking at, in fact, as it happens, IT training in remote rural villages, amongst other things. You know, there sometimes, wherever the residences, there's coverage, and when you drive over the hill where there isn't a residence, then you certainly lose network access till you get to the next little settlement. And I can tell you that from personal experience. But anyway, it's going to redress barriers to entry. What does that mean? The only barriers to entry are regulatory. The bill doesn't redress them. You just discontinue them. That's what you would do. You would stop being a barrier to entry. That's the government's simple choice and option. And it would promote service-based competition. We have service-based competition. Very effective competition, vigorous competition, which I know because I recently decided to have a new cell phone and a new cell phone contract and looked at it. And I can't tell you how they competed with me. I couldn't stop them phoning me to offer me their new and better service. And when I was threatened to leave one and go to another, I was phoned and said, "We're giving you 8 gigs extra data on this, you know, stay with us." And they sort of heaped benefits on me in a very competitive way. And then you're going to promote an environment for open access. Now, what does that mean? I have asked people, in what sense is the existing system not open access? And I can't get an answer. As far as I know, all of the service providers are free to provide service to anyone. And they do with some, and to contract with each other, and they have data roaming and so on. Is that not open access? From all the experts in the industry, I've asked all sorts of people in and out of government. Nobody can tell me why the current system is not called open access. I have been told that there are regulations. The licenses given to the network providers prevent them from giving open access to their network. They have to comply with their license. I haven't studied the licenses, but if that is indeed what the licenses say, then you just remove that restriction and then you have open access. So you either have it already or you allow it. That's how you get open access. You don't need an act and you don't need a new entity of some sort. And then, what is the status quo? Why is it not called open access? Nobody can tell me. And I continue to ask the question. So the FMF is investigating the legality. Is it void for vagueness? Would it be a lawful bill if passed? And we are commissioning a senior counsel opinion, and we will probably engage in litigation. But we have also been told that at least two of the big network, six now network providers, have themselves commissioned senior counsel opinion on the legality of the bill. And at least one of them has told us, without showing us the opinion, that they've been told that it would not be constitutional and lawful. And in any event, they are ready to fight. So this bill, even if it's passed, will actually not come into effect. All it's going to do is bog down the advance of South Africa's spectacular success story, the cell phone industry, and prevent it ever happening. So whether this bill will ever be instituted is unclear, even if it's passed. And it certainly will be the subject of very vigorous legislation which will prevent it being implemented, we are told, by network providers. And I happened to speak to another one over this weekend who said, one of the prospective ones, who said, we will certainly bog this down in legislation to its death. It will never actually happen. Now I'm going to run through our formal submission very quickly because time doesn't allow too much more. There were 43 submissions to the government, 30 presentations, and only four of them to some degree could have been called, one fairly passionately in favor of it, one half in favor. For example, Telkom said they want this wireless open access, which, as we've had explained, is actually a wholesale open access. It's, for those who don't know, we think it's wireless because our phone is wireless, but in fact the whole network is cables and wires under the ground to all the towers. So it's a wire full, not a wireless network. But nonetheless, Telkom said, we want access to the towers, but don't give anyone else access to our wires, our cables. So in other words, we want access to them, but don't give them access to us. Now, whether that's supporting the measure or not is unclear. It's just saying, look, we would like you to promote our vested interests, which is what you'd expect the four to say. They were just four obvious and transparent vested interests, nothing really commenting on the benefits to the country or the intended benefits. There's essentially industry consensus, and then, as we've heard, the independent service providers, I agree, are mistaken in their view that whatever this thing is, they kind of have some vague idea that they will somehow be better off if this vague thing somehow happens. But it's not at all clear what it is that will happen and why they think they will be better off. And I think they're greatly mistaken, because what we are likely to see is we will not get 5G rollout, we will not get 4G extended to a bigger country. Let's be clear about this. This is South Africa's most spectacular post-apartheid success. This is number one. There is nothing else that has happened since 1994 that competes with the success of our telecommunications technology and industry, where we have wider coverage than some first world countries, certainly wider than pretty much any developing country. And If anything, we should say to the rest of the world, come to South Africa and see how we did it. We are the greatest success ever. And you might say, let's do a little bit of tweaking here, a little bit of adjusting there, maybe remove restrictions on license that somehow prevent them from being open access. But to mess with the most successful thing that's happened since apartheid in South Africa just makes no sense at all. And as I will say later, to mess with it with something that has been tried only once in one country, and there are people who will argue that this isn't true, and I would take them on, which is Rwanda, where it's a disaster. Only something like, I think it's 40,000 4G LTE phones. And then there's supposedly Mexico, where the minister interestingly said he'd been to Mexico and seen it working there. He was there 2 years before even the final contract. It's not working. It's not yet instituted. It was going to be some WOAN, some kind of public ownership thing. It's now ended up being outsourced to Nokia. So the whole thing has gone as a monopoly to a foreign company, which has not yet implemented it. So nowhere in the world has this happened, and except in one little country where it's a catastrophe. And so why would we mess up one of South Africa's greatest accomplishments and replace it with something that has never been tried or tested or proven except once where it's been a failure? And it's, you can say Mexico is a failure in the sense that in the end they had to give it to a foreign company anyway. So is that really what we in South Africa want to do? Whereas our companies are such a success, they're going all over the rest of the world, the other way around. You know, we should have gone and taken it over ourselves in Mexico, maybe. So there's global consensus. Nobody does this. Everyone wants competing network providers. Nobody thinks you can run any capital investment by the private sector on cost-based, etc., etc. ICASA, which is, whatever its flaws or weaknesses or inadequacies, I think has actually done a reasonable job. By and large, you know, I think they would have done certain things differently if they had another chance, not a problem. They were fundamentally against it. They absolutely strongly, quite strongly, I actually must say, I've seldom seen one government entity come out with guns blazing against another government entity, in fact, its own department, its own bosses, with such vigor. It is really quite an extraordinary thing to see, and a healthy thing. I'm very glad that they were able, felt free to do that. But the idea is to abolish them and to remove the independence of the agency. Now, many people said in the consultation that that itself would be unconstitutional. I can't myself see why, but they argue that the control of wireless, the control of communications and wireless, according to the Constitution, has to be, and broadcasting has to be independent, but I think that doesn't mean that technical infrastructure has to be, I think there's a difference there. But nonetheless, speaker after speaker said it would be unconstitutional to basically abolish ICASA and remove its independence. The network providers providing, you know, 10 billion rand investment per annum at least, with a new two it might be even more, looks as if it'll be even more. And whether it's constitutional on the basis of the certainty principle, rationality, the right to trade clause, the property rights clause, the human dignity and freedoms clause, that's clause one, and freedom of media, speech, communication, transformation, objectives and so on, all of these it seems would be violated if it went ahead, even if anyone could work out quite what it means. On competition policy, it says it wants to promote competition policy. Well, the way to do that is to allow competition. The market must be what's called contestable to be competitive. It's not about market size or market share. People complain that they're two dominant players. There's nothing in economic theory that tells you that makes it uncompetitive. On the contrary, one market player can be completely competitive provided there's freedom of entry. If you have the only grocery store in a village, you do not have a monopoly unless there's a licensing system. If anyone else is free to open another grocery store, you call that in economics competitive. It's not to do with how many operators there are, what size they are. The socioeconomic, socioeconomic impact assessment. There's a bit of a nasty story to this. I was on SABC debating the minister about the bill some time ago, and I said there's no socio-economic impact assessment, which is compulsory by virtue of a cabinet resolution. And he said, yes, it is. It's on the website. Mr. Lowe just hasn't seen it. So he made me look as if I'm uninformed. Well, I thought, that's strange. I haven't. And I went and looked, and lo and behold, they posted it on the website the night before the radio debate the next morning. So it was a ploy, I should imagine, just to make me feel, to make me look as if I'm uninformed. However, the thing itself is a fake document. It doesn't meet any of the requirements of the cabinet guidelines on how to complete them, it doesn't meet the requirements of a socio-economic impact assessment. Some of it's PDF, and you can unpack a PDF in layers, and you can see that the original one was in fact started some months before, but the final bits were added literally the day before. And so it was unfortunately a sort of dirty trick. Anyway, I don't know what's happening over here, why this is doing this. Anyway, then there's this talk of universal coverage. What does that mean? Does it mean every square foot of the country, or does it mean 100% of the population? And if that, does it mean where they live, or does it mean where they work, or does it mean the farms on which they farm, or whatever? Nobody knows. And so to move on, the Free Market Foundation, which wants free people, South Africa's greatest post-apartheid accomplishment, as I say, with now some over 100 billion rands of private investment that cost the public and the government nothing, and is one of the country's greatest ever success stories. There should be spectrum ownership and trading, in our view. That is the best way to allocate it. And I'm going to move on somewhat quickly because our time is really up. There are what I call gadfly fallacies. People will say that duplication of infrastructure should be prevented. You heard Adrian talk about wanting one infrastructure provider for this complex, for example. And the idea is somehow that's a good thing, that if you reduce duplication of infrastructure. Well, that's like saying we should have only one restaurant in Sandton, because if we have two, we're duplicating infrastructure, or one shopping center, or one filling station. I mean, nobody argues this for anything else. Well, why did they get away with it with telecommunications? It's completely irrational. You want duplication of infrastructure. That's called competition. And so the bill says on one hand it doesn't want duplication, but it wants competition. Well, make up your mind. And more importantly, there should be freedom of entry. So even if there is one single provider, that's not the problem. The problem is if you don't allow others to enter, which the bill says it wants, and it says it doesn't want. So quite which it is, nobody knows. This idea of spectrum squatting, that unused spectrum, so if you have a certain wavelength, a certain amount of spectrum, and you're using only 75% of it, the idea is that some will be taken back because it's an unutilized allocated resource. Well, that's also false economics. False economics works on the basis of the Coase theorem, is that if there's freedom of trade in any resource, you can presume that it will be allocated to the optimal user. That's what markets are for. That's why you want competition. That's the purpose of competition, is the advancement of the Coase theorem in economics. Then you want auctions are the best way to determine prices, and you want spectrum trade, it's the best way to bring about efficient allocation, and you don't want coercive open access networks versus spontaneous ones. In other words, just allow any service provider to provide open access, and as far as I can tell, they're already free. So we have open access already. I can't understand what anyone's, what they think is wrong with what we've got. And I'm closing with this slide, which is the three most strident opponents at the consultation were ICASA and the two big operators, Vodacom and MTN. And Shamil Yusuf of Vodacom said, the minute you talk about returning spectrum, it makes the entire network useless. Now, that's strong language, and you've heard that explained why that would be the case. And he called it the Telecommunication Mining Charter. Now, the Mining Charter resulted in basically the end of investment in the mining industry and South Africa tumbling from being one of the world's leading minerals producers to a low-level operator, and South Africa completely missing what was called the minerals boom, or the opportunity that many other countries took. Godfrey Mortsa of MTN provided a really impassioned opposition. I've never seen anything quite like it from a CEO, and we'd hoped to have MTN represented here today. And he accused the government openly of negotiating in bad faith, which we've also heard about from Adrian, that apparently deals were struck behind closed doors. I don't know what they were, and maybe some of the people in the room do. I see some very knowledgeable people with us, which is an honor. And the government negotiated, made everyone think a deal had been struck, and they all knew where they were going, and then all of a sudden it proceeded with a white paper as if nothing had happened, which had been widely and virtually universally condemned. So we have the resurrection and of the unreconstructed witty paper, white paper, as if no evidence had been led. So with that, that's the end of my presentation. I think we have here something that is extraordinarily serious. This is something that affects every South African. There are more cell phones in South Africa than there are people, and that is because something like 80% of South Africans have a cell phone, and some people have two or three, and the remaining 20% of people who probably just don't want one, they're too young or too old. Very occasionally people will be too poor, so all the talk about it being expensive. I saw a housekeeper in a little village recently in northern KZN where she had two cell phones lying on the counter, and I asked her why, and she said one is MTN and one is Vodacom, and I said why, and she said, well, if the one doesn't work, the other one works. And here's a very lowly paid, very, very modest income person living literally in a Zulu mud hut village with two cell phones, and one of them was a smartphone, one of them not. And so this is a fantastic success of South Africa, and we really should not mess with it. We really should cherish it, hold it up as a sample, to model to the rest of the world, of probably the single greatest post-apartheid accomplishment, other than obviously freedom itself. Thank you.